This show proudly sponsored by Real American Freestyle Wrestling. Recently, a close friend of mine experienced an unexpected loss. Watching their family struggle emotionally and financially made me stop and think seriously about my own family's future. As the primary provider, I know how important it is to make sure that if anything ever happened to me, my family would still be able to manage. So I realized that without life insurance, my family would be left with overwhelming financial burdens. I looked into coverage before, but the process always felt complicated, got endless forms, phone calls, and medical exams, made everything take weeks. So that's why Ethos stood out to me. Their process is simple and 100% online. There's no medical exam required, just a few health questions, and you get a quote in as little as 10 minutes. In many cases, you can even receive same-day coverage without ever leaving your house. Ethos offers up to $3 million in coverage, with some policies starting as low as $2 a day, billed monthly. It's a trustworthy company that's changing the way people think about life insurance. So protect your family's financial future with life insurance from Ethos. Get your free quote at ethos.com/Brian. That's ethos.com/Brian. Application times may vary. Rates may vary.
News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're there. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. We got a big hour coming your way. I think that within this hour, we're going to have the mayor-elect of New York City. Every time he talks, it's interesting because he's a flat-out socialist, doesn't like democracy, doesn't really like capitalism. We'll find out where he stands because tomorrow he's going to meet with the president. Senator Tommy Tuberville is standing by. Neil Chatterjee is going to be with us, too. Chief of Government Affairs at Palmetto, former chairman of Federal Energy Regulation Commission under President Trump, senior advisor to Mitch McConnell. So let's get to the big three.
Number three.
I believe that Jeffrey Epstein had information and I was going to get information. You get information from people where you can. I've interviewed narcotics, drug traffickers and others. And that doesn't mean that I'm their friend.
That is Stacey Plaskett. What a joke. Getting text messages from Jeffrey Epstein, a personal relationship. They have cell phone numbers, but she's a prosecutor. Dumb. Boomerang. The Epstein files begin to leak out, and it's the Dems that are front and center. Why I think more than just disgraced Harvard and Obama and Clinton official Larry Summers is just the first lefty to pay the price.
Number two.
This administration is pitting our uniformed military
and intelligence community professionals
against American citizens.
You can refuse illegal orders.
You must refuse illegal orders.
So that's Mark Kelly, Alyssa Slotkin, Jason Crow, doing something I think is borderline treasonous. The Democratic vets show their radical side by putting a message out to the military. In my view, borders on treason and also looks for them just to, I guess, turn against Pete Hegseth and Donald Trump. The blowback is just beginning.
Number one.
We did reach out to the White House, and my team reached out because of a commitment that I made to New Yorkers, that I would be willing to meet with anyone and everyone so long as it was to the benefit of the 8.5 million people who call the city home and their struggle to afford the most expensive city in the United States of America.
Yeah, Mayor Mamdani, elect, I should say. Guess who's coming to lunch? Mamdani coming to visit President Trump at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Let's see if this odd couple can last three seasons. Let's bring in Senator Tommy Tuberville, now Armed Services Committee, and who's likely to be the next governor of Alabama. Senator, welcome back.
Morning, Brian. How are you?
I'm doing great. Because some good news. They thought 50,000 jobs in September because everything was shut down. We had no numbers. Looks like America added 119,000 jobs. Unemployment ticked up to 4.4%, but a big improvement in hospitality, construction, and health care, while cutting back about 100,000 federal jobs. What do you make of this?
Well, first of all, you can count on these being correct. You know, the first 4 years I was here, Brian, under Joe Biden, every one of these reports was wrong. Every one of them. And they were embellished. And it gave actually the people across the country hope. But at the end of the day, after every report, 3 months later, they come out, well, we were a little bit off. We're 50% off here. 80% off here. It's amazing. These are true reports. It shows our economy is good. It's not great, obviously, with this shutdown that Schumer orchestrated, put us in harm's way to some degree. But I was glad to see this happen. Very positive in American people going into the holiday season, knowing that there's more and more jobs opening.
So Senator, why do you think they're more accurate now? Aren't the same people doing this that were doing it under Biden?
No, not quite. And there's oversight. We got oversight on it, Brian. We saw the mess. We understood that. Now that we're in charge, we have oversight on this. And, they might not be perfect, but they're not going to be 50% off, 60% off, and it's not going to change in 3 months. So we need accurate data, to run this country. But obviously the Democrats don't believe in that.
So a couple of things. If Fox does a poll, and I know the president doesn't love our polls, and I have nothing to do with it, so I wouldn't take it personal if you don't like them either. But Fox News does a poll. They ask people, are you satisfied with the economy? Only 25% are satisfied. In July, the number was 32%. In January, 30%. They ask, is inflation under control? Completely 2%, mostly 16%, somewhat 29%, not at all 52%. And have you been helped or hurt by President Trump's economic policies? Helped 15, hurt 46. What does Tommy Tuberville think?
Well, first of all, we look back at inflation. It was 9% about 3 years ago. And now it's much, much lower. And going to go lower. The problem people need to understand is when President Trump took over, we had flushed out $7 to $8 trillion in this economy that we should never have spent. And that's where the inflation's coming from. They made the dollar cheaper, and it was way out of control. These people, the Democrats, they never had a plan. So for 8-9 months now, President Trump's trying to get his head above water from things happening overseas to the border to the economy to the tariffs. You know, people complain to me in Alabama about tariffs. I say, listen, here's the deal. We're $38 trillion in debt. There's no way we can tax the American people to ever even come close to paying a small percentage of that down. Tariffs have to do it. And it's your only chance for taxes to just skyrocket. So President Trump's got a plan. Scott Bessent's got a plan. But again, we've got to dig ourselves out of this hole. And it wasn't put in there by the Republicans. It was put in there by the socialist, communist Democrats. And it's going to get worse if we listen to this nonsense. Let President Trump do his job. And in 6-7 months, you're going to see a much better economy in this country. And President Trump understands what he's doing. And thank God he works 18 hours a day to get it done.
Right. And work ethic, and nothing can substitute it. Forget about talent. If you have the work ethic and the good people around you, you're going to be successful. Same thing in sports. Yeah. So for the longest time, I haven't been talking about the Epstein files. One of the main reasons is this is an old story. The victims are terrible. I feel bad for the victims, but this is not about the victims. Tom Massie and Ro Khanna looking out for the victims after not saying a word about it all their other years in Congress. Don't get me going on this. And this seems to me to be the ultimate boomerang. They're going for Trump. But as more and more paperwork gets released, this seems to be blowing out Democrats like Larry Summers, the lawyer over at Goldman Sachs, this woman, Stacey Plaskett, a congresswoman from the Virgin Islands. Where is this heading, do you think, as this comes out?
Well, it's going to be bad. It's going to be bad for a lot of people that really wanted it to come out. Here's a process. Again, as I said earlier, President Trump, he's had more on his plate than any president ever, just trying to save the country and really save the world. But and he said, listen, transparency, we're going to release the files. Now, I've talked to Kash Patel and Pam Bondi. Here's the deal. You've got to do a little bit of investigation. You just can't throw it out there and end up with mud on your face if some of this is not right or wrong. So they've been, President Trump wanted a good investigation. Look into it. Make sure everything is kosher here. Let's don't jump a gun because there's no reason to do it. But the Democrats, they just knew President Trump was involved. So they kept hammering him. So what happened? Okay, you want it out? I know what's in it. We're going to let it out. Hakeem Jeffries, get ready. And so he released it last night. You're going to see it slowly come out. And now there might be some Republicans in there, but it is going to be detrimental to the Democratic Party. They wanted it. You got it, folks. Have a good holiday season. And if you're crooked, let's put you in jail.
So here is what James Comer on Oversight said. Cut 19.
I subpoenaed the estate, and lo and behold, you saw with the last batch of documents that came in, there were emails that implicated Democrats. Two Democrat members of Congress, Hakeem Jeffries, the minority leader, his campaign was soliciting funds from Epstein, even told him they would meet privately with Epstein if he would make a big enough donation.
And we know that his name, Trump name, kept popped up because the guy hated him. He was maneuvering with Stacey Plaskett to try to nail Michael Cohen to hurt Donald Trump. The reporter from the New York Times, desperate to hurt Michael to Donald Trump. Michael Wolff in 2015, Jeffrey, you're the one that could stop him. You have the silver bullet. So you have journalists working with Democrats and Epstein to stop Trump. And that's why he's mentioned early and often.
Yeah. Yeah. John Wayne's, my favorite saying from John Wayne was, life's tough. It's a lot tougher when you're stupid. So you're seeing a lot of this right now. These people are just, they would sink their own ship to get Donald Trump. They would do that. And so they don't want to work for the country or work for the American citizen. They work for the Democrats and the Communist Party. And so good luck to them. And, you know, I'm proud President Trump. But look at this. This thing went through like lightning, went through the House and went through the Senate. President Trump signed it. That's how really things should work around here. But they don't. But this one did. And it's going to pay dividends for the election next year for the Republicans, because you're going to see a lot of people that's going to be caught in the tailwinds here.
So the average person, especially in Alabama, you know, if you have Obamacare, you know, your deductible is like $6,000 or $7,000. You know that almost all these private companies like Cigna and Aetna and United have dropped out of the exchanges. The whole premise behind Obamacare is falling apart, but yet 54% of the country still look at it positively. So with the rates going up, you just worry about the people, not just that voted for you, just especially if you're going to be governor, Senator Tuberville. So right now, I hear there was a serious effort, bipartisan effort yesterday and maybe today, to try to fix this on the fly, to try to help ease the pain on health care for some of the people. Could you let me know, do you know what happened at all with Senator Cassidy's committee?
Well, they're trying to come up with a plan to ease the pain on the American citizens. Brian, Obamacare has been a complete disaster, and it never should have come to the point where it has to be subsidized by the American people. Folks, you citizens, you are paying twice for this health care. You're paying illegals for their health care. Health care is a disaster when it comes. We're losing doctors. We're losing nurses. We're losing surgical centers. We've gone to just big hospitals, and the insurance companies are getting subsidized right and left. It is not – Obamacare was never for the American people. It was for politicians and for big corporations, and we got to get control of it. We used to have the best health care system in the world, but now it's a disaster because of what we call – the Unaffordable Care Act.
So here's what Senator Bill Cassidy said came out of yesterday. You don't have much time. Cut 26.
We're having a Senate Finance Committee hearing, and we'll hear about the situation. But let's elaborate on the president's plan. There's $26 billion available, if you will, for what Joe Biden put in as enhanced premium tax credits. The Democrats want to send that $26 billion back to the insurance companies. They take 20% of that for profit and overhead. That's law under Obamacare. They're allowed to take that 20%.
And he went on, cut 27.
The president and I want to send 100% to patients to put into an account to spend on the health care that they want, not just the health care that the insurance company allows them to have. And by the way, with this money, they can pay their deductible and their copay. Under the Democratic plan, there'll be maybe a $7,000 deductible before you get into the insurance. Under the Republican plan, there'll be $1,000 to $2,000 to pay for that health care before you kind of start paying out of pocket for your deductible. It works for the patient. It gives power to the patient. I'm with the president. This is a better plan.
So I'm sure you've heard some of this, Senator. So your thoughts on that and the fact that Democrats signing on to it, maybe being a part of it. If it's a Republican plan, you know they're just not going to take it. So,
No. But
could it be, do you think they're playing ball here?
They're not going to play ball because it takes money out of the corporations and gives it back to the citizens to have a health care account. That's the way it should have been all along. But the Obamacare wanted all the money to go to corporations, insurance companies, and just try to drive out the middleman and give money to the PBMs, give money to the drug companies. That's not what this is about. It should be about the American citizen first and foremost. And that's what this health care account is all about. President Trump wants to instigate that, but the Democrats want to give it the subsidies to the insurance companies.
So Senator, do you think, how many senators do you think, they know it's a problem, right? We're a
year
out of an election. So do you think there's anyone there on the left that would say, okay, Senator Cassidy, you were a doctor. Rick Scott, you ran hospitals. Barrasso, you were a doctor. Like, how do we do this? Is there anyone looking just to fix it?
Yeah, well, we're trying to give them an alternative. But here's the deal, Brian. And up here in Washington, D.C., once you get a plan, then you have to market it, then you have to sell it. I think that's one of the worst things that we do as Republicans, because we don't have the bulk of the mainstream media that will help us sell it. So we're going to spend money on it. And we've got to make the American people understand what we're trying to do. We're trying to get rid of this nonsense of Unaffordable Care Act and give people money to where they can actually afford health insurance and get the best in, health care and get the best health care in the country.
Lastly, Senator, are you going to try? I know you and Joe Manchin were trying to work out something with college sports and getting some regulation. They want the regulation. You know all the coaches, former coaches and players. You have such credibility. Have you thought about doing something? Because this is it will be embraced, I think, by college sports about the NIL and paying players.
Yeah. You know, it's a disaster. And it's getting worse.
Yep.
One thing, there's no education in it. I've talked to the president many times. He and I are working on a plan to, in just one area, to help it, to slow it down. I'm all for players making money. It was a disaster. NCAA caused all this. They should have given revenue sharing years ago, but they didn't do it. And so now the players are getting their own money. That's fine. But we've got to put education back into this. We've got to quit letting them transfer every year, because you'll never get a degree. It's not about education anymore. I'm for them to be able to get the best opportunity. But once you sign that contract, you got to uphold that. We're teaching the wrong things in sports right now. It used to be one of the best things going, but we're teaching the wrong things. Again, let them make money. I'm all for that. But we've got to instigate some kind of rules and regulations. We're working on it. Hopefully we can get it done soon.
Do you have a committee?
Oh, yeah, I've had committee. Joe Manchin and I worked on it for 2 years with Ted Cruz, and the Commerce Committee is working on it. Nobody wants to agree on it. But I think at the end of the day, we need to do some kind of executive order for a few years to give it a shot. Hey, here's what we're going to do for a few years. And if it works, then you implement it. But somebody's got to be convinced of it.
All right, good. Executive order. Just whatever you do. I've never seen a league or any situation where they're saying, please regulate me. Senator Tommy Tuberville, best of luck in your run for governor. And thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you. Happy Thanksgiving.
You got it. Back in a moment.
Learning something new every day on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Every day, America's first responders stand ready. Firefighters, law enforcement, paramedics, doctors, dispatchers, and people who put themselves on the line for public safety. But keeping them connected in moments of crisis has not been easy. That's why Congress authorized a nationwide network for public safety. Today, that promise is fulfilled through FirstNet. It's the only nationwide network built with and for first responders. So whether it's a big city, rural town, or remote tribal community, FirstNet helps ensure no call for help goes unanswered. It gives first responders priority access, never throttles their communications in the U.S., helping them to connect across agencies when it matters most. This isn't just a network. It's a lifeline, a bipartisan commitment to America's public safety, built to serve those who serve us all. FirstNet is the backbone of our nation's emergency response and will continue to be in the future. FirstNet, built with AT&T. Learn more on firstnet.com/public safety first.
A radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
I believe that Jeffrey Epstein had information, and I was going to get information to get at the truth. Having a friendship with him is not something that I would deem to have. And so I'm just looking forward. I'm moving forward. And I think that that's what we as American people should do, is move forward.
Sorry, not going to work, Stacey Plackett. You're over in the Virgin Islands. You said he was a constituent of mine because he owned an island and maybe had some real estate there. This guy was a confidant. He had your cell number. He was feeding you lines to help sink Donald Trump by going after his attorney. They brought up the name Rona Graff. Rona, she thought, it's because it's spelled R-H-O-N-A. They say, what kind of acronym is that? She writes. She goes, it's not an acronym. It's his chief assistant. 2 minutes later, she's asking that very question from Jeffrey Epstein to Michael Cohen. But of course, she says, I'm looking forward. I'm looking forward. When this exchange happened, he already been to jail for being with underage girls. And he's got out and she's still dealing with him. But it's Donald Trump's that the problem. You know, you have Kara Swisher, very bright, successful podcast, says it's over for Trump. Really? It's over for Donald Trump? You tried to sue him. You tried to put him in jail. He almost got killed twice. He won an election, lost an election, won an election again. Popular vote. But you're going to stop him with a guy that's been dead since 2019 who killed himself. Nice try. You watch how many Democrats are going to be caught in the crosshairs of the Jeffrey Epstein files as thousands of pages get lost. Talk about that in a moment. What if your home security could stop a break-in before it even begins? That's not science fiction. That's SimpliSafe. And right now, their early access Black Friday sale is changing how we think about protection. Traditional systems wait until someone's already breaking in. SimpliSafe's Active Guard outdoor protection, powered by AI, detects threats before they reach your door. Real security agents jump in instantly, confronting intruders, letting them know they are on camera and the police are on their way. And if needed, sending off sirens and spotlights. It's proactive protection that stops crime before it happens. And here's the best part. No long-term contracts, no hidden fees, and you can cancel anytime. It's been named Best Home Security System by U.S. News & World Report for 5 years straight. And with a 60-day money-back guarantee, you can try completely risk-free. So, if home safety's been on your mind, this is your moment. Right now, my listeners can take advantage of their biggest sale of the year with this exclusive early access to SimpliSafe's Black Friday sale. And save 60% on any new system by going to simplisafe.com/Brian. There will never be a better time to get real security for your home. Go to simplisafe.com/Brian. Stay protected and stay one step ahead with SimpliSafe.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Under the deals being signed this week, the world's two leading energy superpowers, America and Saudi Arabia, are partnering on energy like we've never partnered before. American Saudi companies represented here today are joining on liquefied natural gas, infrastructure, constructions, and making both of our energy sections, I mean, our sectors are becoming so strong.
And the president yesterday at Investors Conference, Kennedy Center, with Saudi Arabian's prince, MBS, and they pledged, I think, $570 billion to various projects. And literally, you didn't have to go anywhere. Oracle was there. Apple was there. You had Goldman Sachs was there. J.P. Morgan. So, I mean, everyone was represented so they could do instant deals with the head of their companies. Neil Chatterjee was chief of government affairs at Palmetto, is there now. Former chairman of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission under President Trump. Former senior advisor to Mitch McConnell. Neil is back in studio. So, Neil, your thoughts about this Saudi deal? I mean, for the longest time, the biggest thing was, could we get the Saudis to, you know, to pump more oil? Let's have them control the price. Now it seems like we have a very integrated relationship from AI to oil and gas, obviously, and now military.
Yeah, look, I mean, this is a seminal moment in foreign policy. I think, you know, the president is – you know, he's not someone that's kind of beholden to norms and the status quo. And obviously there's controversy when it comes to dealing with the Saudis. You know, ask Rory McIlroy, who turned down, you know, like $800 million to play on the LIV tour. There's controversy when it comes to Saudi, but the president is, you know, looking at America's interest and where he can broker relationships that are going to better enable things like energy, like powering the AI boom. And he found a partner in the Saudis. I also think it's relevant that the Saudis came to the table because, you know, we can now match them when it comes to energy. I mean, historically, we have been, you know, kind of dependent on
the 70s, especially, remember?
I mean, we've been dependent on the Middle East for our energy, for our oil. We are now an energy superpower here in the U.S. thanks to a lot of the deregulatory steps combined with innovation that have enabled us. I was very proud during my tenure at the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. I think we approved about a dozen liquefied natural gas export facilities, and now the U.S. is a dominant player in the space. And so the Saudis have to come to the table because we've got leverage.
So we're refining at a good rate. No one's saying the refinery's a problem. We're pumping oil at a good rate. No one says that's a problem. So having said that, we're looking for gas prices to come down. And I also got calls from truckers who tell me it's diesel. Diesel is above gas. Here's what Senator Mark Wayne Mullen said is the reason.
I got a lot of calls last week about diesel. Diesel's with the trucks in. Diesel's above gas. And I think it's because of the sulfur regulations, because sulfur's bad for the environment, and they got all these sulfur regulators on. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, I drive a diesel every single day. Before we were in Congress, we had a whole bunch of trucks, semis on the road every day. Diesel has been higher than gasoline now for almost a little over a decade because of, you know, environmental requirements. There's a lot can be done with that. I've talked to Duffy, Secretary Duffy, about this. I've talked to Lee Zeldin about this multiple times, about what we can do about regulations to bring down that cost.
So what is the challenge with diesel? Is it the environment? Is it the sulfur?
I mean, you know, regulatory policy definitely has an impact on price. I also think demand is part of the issue. You know, we've got the refining capacity. We've got the supply. I think, look, this administration, to their credit, they're not getting credit for it. You know, everywhere you turn, people are talking about affordability, 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 and they're criticizing the administration for not being focused on affordability. Energy is at the core of when it comes to affordability. People focus on gas prices in particular because it's evident. They see it on giant signs, you know,
yeah, it's not high, but it didn't come back as low as
you expect. But it didn't come back as low, and so people are critiquing the administration. To me, the bigger issue is electricity prices. That's where I tend to focus. That's where my expertise is. And electric bills are rising, and I think that is giving folks
– isn't that a state pause. Thing?
It's somewhat states. We do have – vertically integrated utilities throughout the country who are in states where, you know, they set the rates. But you also have competitive power markets. That's what the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission that I ran, we oversaw those competitive power markets. And what's just happening right now is you've got a combination of factors. Some of this was driven, quite frankly, by the Biden administration. During the Biden administration, my former colleagues at FERC took steps that I've believed to be political in nature. They artificially suppressed capacity prices. This is a really wonky, technical, nerdy thing. But the bottom line is they tried to accelerate the retirement of fossil generators to open up markets to cleaner energy. And the end result of that is now we have demand for electricity spiking because of AI and data centers needed to support AI and streaming services and crypto and Bitcoin mining. All of these things require a lot of power. So power bills are going up, and the Democrats are trying to pin that on the Trump administration. But the reality is we're reeling from decisions that were made by the Biden administration that are still hurting consumers.
So they're talking about nuclear. Just back to the Saudi deal real quick. Some people are getting nervous. Hey, do we really want to bring nuclear energy to the Saudis? Chris Wright, who's the energy secretary, brought that answer that question. Cut 23.
There are concerns about the Saudis have long wanted to, you know, enrich uranium domestically. There are concerns about that because it can be used for either civilian or military purposes. Is that something that is going to be addressed in this agreement?
No enrichment in this agreement. This is just for civil nuclear construction of a power plant, American technology, American companies to build a very large nuclear power plant in Saudi Arabia.
And how do you feel about that? I heard if you're going to use enrichment, you know, the way the UAE does it, you take the enrichment out. You bring it in, you take it out. They don't hold on to it. That's the way Iran agreed originally to send their enriched uranium to Russia for a while for a huge price.
Yeah, we've done this before. Look, I was a young congressional aide during the Bush administration when we struck a civilian nuclear deal with India. And, you know, it's had a positive impact. Look, nuclear power is our single greatest form of
clean,
carbon-free, clean, baseload power. And so opponents of this who simultaneously claim they care about the climate, look, I care about the environment. I want nuclear power. I'm supportive of nuclear power. We need to do everything we can to expand our utilization of nuclear power. And folks who are being critical of this, in my view, are hypocrites, right? You can't simultaneously say you care about the environment and be critical of nuclear
power. How about this? You have China is now the leader because they went to the COP convention over in Brazil. We didn't go first time. And China now is the leader. But China's building a coal plant a week. I mean, they have special dispensation. They don't have to pay any carbon tax credits because they're looked at as a developing nation. So John Kerry was on C-SPAN and talked about his great love of climate change, which I think people are sobering up to it from Bill Gates on down. Cut 25.
You saw what happened to Jamaica. You see what happened in California. You see what's happening around the world. There is everything we are doing, those of us advocating for this, does not come out of any ideology, any party, any philosophy. It comes out of physics, science. This is about physics.
Is it? A hurricane is do we have hurricanes before we had power?
Look, what Secretary Kerry has never understood is he believes that government is the solution to these kinds of problems. I am a firm believer in markets, and that's been the problem is they've tried to put their thumb on the scale to influence markets. The reality is we are deploying clean energy at a fast rate here in this country, not because we're trying to solve for some governmental equation, because it makes business sense, because it's economically sound, because the costs of clean energy have come down and consumers are now finding it more attractive and reliable. And look, when your electricity bill is spiking, you know what's a good alternative? Residential rooftop solar. You can get off the grid, take control of your, energy costs and demonstrate savings. It's not governmental policy that's driving these kinds of things. It's what consumers want. And I think the John Kerry's of the world have quite frankly set us back because they've tried to bring the heavy hand of government down.
And they kept saying, talking apocalyptic in ways, the world's going to end. We think to ourselves, well, what are you talking about? But he made a whole generation crazed. They actually would have trouble sleeping. They're anxiety filled. They've been told by their science teachers in grammar school and junior high and high school that we're irresponsible to be driving a car or getting in a plane. And how dare we? And that's why you have these activists stopping pipelines. When you think, what are you upset about a North Dakota pipeline for? Does anyone understand the science behind it? It's because of people like that. And they make a ton of money from this. Al Gore, how much money has he made from climate change?
Yeah, I mean, it's about politics. It's about moving people. They thought it was going to be a political wedge issue. It would have been better for the planet. It would have been better for humanity if they hadn't politicized it. If we had just made it about the economics, about people being able to have clean energy in an affordable way and not layer on this kind of apocalyptic rhetoric, I honestly think by politicizing climate action, they made it political.
So the same with the conservatives, when they grab something and people go, oh, that's what the right wing thinks. So I think to myself, well, no, that's what's good for the country, but it looks like a right-wing principle. I'll give you an example. There might be elements of Obamacare that Republicans signed on to, but it's so polarized, if they agree to anything, it's going to be their political detriment. That's why to do health care, they got to do it right and starting now. They got to do it together. They need the cover on both sides. How do we handle our grid? We keep hearing our grid is overwhelmed. It's about to get truly overwhelmed. We're building more power stations. If I ask Neil Chatterjee, how do I fix the grid? Or how do I rebuild and get a new grid? What would you do?
I would move to more distributed generation, virtual power plants. So when I was at FERC, I moved this order that I'm very proud of, FERC Order 2222. My daughter's birthday is February 2nd, so I kind of named it after her with all the twos. What it does is it enables aggregated distributed energy resources, think electric vehicles, rooftop solar, advanced appliances, to be compensated for putting power back onto the grid. I think we're going to see this huge surge in demand for power being driven by AI. How we meet that surge in demand while keeping electricity affordable and reliable to make sure that when Americans hit the switch, the lights come on, that on the coldest day of winter you have heat, on the hottest day of summer you have air conditioning. In order to do that, I think we need to move to a more distributed grid. The tools are all there. We've got to do some smart policy. We need to build more transmission lines in this country. We need to build more natural gas pipelines. We need permitting reform. You mentioned China building a coal plant a
week. Can we do the permitting reform?
We have to.
Oh, is it through executive orders? You have to go to Congress?
I think we've got to go through Congress. I think there's actual momentum in Congress on this. I actually think AI is going to be this variable that kind of unifies us.
Here's
on
the crazy
energy
thing,
politics.
Neil. For the longest time, Silicon Valley left-wing causes, right? Silicon Valley gets so burned with social media, the pandemic, everything like that. They felt like the oppression came from the left. Now they're open, obviously, to the president. They're attending all his conferences. Then you get this other wing, the AI guys. You know, the AI guys are less political. So it used to be left wing, left coast, Silicon Valley. That's. But I think it's so blended now. I'm hoping it transfers to Congress. That don't stand against AI. Don't stand against power. Bill Gates comes out and says, listen, I was wrong. The world's not going to end. We got to be smart about this. So I'm sensing that AI is apolitical. What do you hear him? Because you're a Washington guy.
Yeah, we've got to do a better job of making the case for why AI is important. It's too easy.
But it needs to be powered, and you can't stop it. So I don't
power
think we've made
the power is the limiting factor. Power and
do
water.
Do you really have to make the case for AI at this point?
I think so.
Really?
I think a lot of people I talk to still think AI is about making goofy cat videos or enabling high school kids to cheat on papers. I am firmly in the camp that I believe AI has huge national security implications, that warfare in the late 21st century will not be fought by human beings, but will be fought by drones and robots and AI. We have to win it. We cannot allow the Chinese Communist Party to beat us in the AI race. And in order to do so, we need a tremendous amount of electric power.
And they're Chinese are way ahead of us on power.
We got to catch them. And so that's going to mean a reawakening on energy politics in this country.
Can you imagine if a left-winger, green-focused president, we'd be destroyed?
The political left has to recognize right now, in order to win the AI race, we cannot do it without fossil fuels. We're going to need at least natural gas for the foreseeable future, and that's going to mean more gas turbines, more gas pipelines, and the political left has to accept that. The political right, however, also has to understand we can't do it with fossil fuels alone. We're going to need solar
exactly.
And storage and
so
geothermal.
So you take politics out of it.
Take the politics out of it.
And find out what wind can do and you find out what solar can do without selling out your conservative costs, right?
100%.
That's what we got to do.
And we got to make it about national security, yep. Not about apocalyptic scenarios.
And the energy secretary can go a long way in doing that. Maybe a politician can't, but an energy secretary can. Burgum understands it too.
Yeah.
He's got an energy portfolio. Neil, always great to talk to you. Your expertise is needed more than ever. Neil Chatterjee, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Back in a moment.
From breaking news to big name guests, Brian brings you insight you won't hear anywhere else. You're listening to The Brian Kilmeade Show.
It's Will Kane Country. Watch it live at noon Eastern, Monday through Thursday at foxnews.com or on the Fox News YouTube channel. And don't miss the show. Listen and follow the podcast 5 days a week at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you download your favorite podcasts.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show, Brian Kilmeade.
So glad you're there. 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan is where I am. Don't come inside. You need a pass. But I come to, I'm going to know, broadcasting around the world. So I appreciate everyone being with us. Bottom of the hour, one of the superstars, emerging superstars in Congress, Brandon Gill of Texas. The congressman will be with us. Judiciary budget oversight. Yeah, oversight will be big. Josh Krasauer standing by. Fox News Radio political analyst. Editor-in-chief of the Jewish Insider. We got some jobs numbers, and the market loves those job numbers. It was supposed to be 50,000, 119,000. Unemployment barely ticks up, but here's what the experts tell me is significant about the market going up 500 points right now, is that it might not have gone up. If things look too good, that means they don't cut rates. The sense is the job numbers at 100-plus thousand still would not stop rates from being cut. If rates don't get cut, then the market's going to suffer because they want people in the market. They want interest rates low. They want people buying houses. So let's get to the big three.
Number three.
I believe that Jeffrey Epstein had information and I was going to get information. You get information from people where you can. I've interviewed narcotics, drug traffickers and others, and that doesn't mean that I'm their friend.
That is Delegate Stacey Plaskett, caught red-handed texting back and forth with Jeffrey Epstein during testimony to destroy Trump. Boomerang. The Epstein files begin to leak out and the Dems are front and center. Why, I think, more than just disgraced Harvard, Obama, and Clinton official Larry Summers is the first lefty but not the last one to pay the price.
Number two.
This administration is pitting our uniformed military
and intelligence community professionals
against American citizens.
You can refuse illegal orders.
You must refuse illegal orders.
That is Mark Kelly, Alyssa Slotkin, and Jason Crow. I would have expected the squad to do a tape like that, not veterans. Treasonous, borderline. The Democratic vets share their radical side by getting a message to the military that they don't have to obey orders they don't like. Let the blowback begin.
Number one.
We did reach out to the White House, and my team reached out because of a commitment that I made to New Yorkers, that I would be willing to meet with anyone and everyone so long as it was to the benefit of the 8.5 million people who call the city home and their struggle to afford the most expensive city in the United States of America.
Guess who's coming to lunch? Zohreh Mamdani, coming to visit President Trump tomorrow. Let's see if the odd couple can survive three seasons. Josh Krashauer joins us now. Josh, that's going to be one interesting visit. Do you sense that we're going to have a minute where both sides come out and meet the press after their closed-door meeting?
Boy, this is must-see TV, Brian, tomorrow, where you have Mamdani, being invited to the White House. And this is going to be, I think, the battle royale in politics for the next year. I expect Mamdani to be a foil for the president, as he already is. And look, I think Mamdani, knowing his history, knowing his record, is not going to be, all that polite. And I think there could be some pretty spirited clashes that take place. So this is going to be a very interesting scene tomorrow at the White House. It is notable that he's accepting the outreach. Mamdani is. But look.
No. It's Trump that accepted the outreach.
I say okay. I guess it's a mutual agreement for the mayor to come. But look, it's a moment. Yesterday, you saw Mamdani announcing officially that he was going to be reappointing or keeping on Jessica Tisch as the NYPD commissioner. So we'll see how much of this is a newfound perhaps pragmatism, and how much of this is trying for him to kind of show that he can confront Trump to his base.
All right, let's start with Jessica Tisch. Why would she stay on if she didn't get any concessions, like being able to add 5,000 police officers? How about no more domestic disputes being handled by social workers? Let's not set up a independent agency to handle discipline should a police officer need it. But I'm not sure she got anything out of it. Cut five is Mamdani talking about domestic violence.
What we did say, however, in the campaign is that it's untenable for officers to be asked to respond to the 200,000 mental health calls they receive every year, to be tasked with the responsibility of taking on the mental health crisis, the homelessness crisis.
Yeah, they had a homeless unit. That idiot Pryor, de Blasio, disbanded it. And they have 36,000 officers. Over the course of a year, you can do multiple stops. To think that social workers are going to do that is just insane.
Well, Brian, you've hit the major tension point that's going to come sooner, I would imagine, rather than later. Yes, it's helpful politically for Mamdani to keep on the NYPD commissioner who has lowered crime, who has taken on some of the radical elements and actually focused on policing and just getting bad guys off the streets. But the ideology that Mamdani, you're pointing to some of the most controversial and unpopular parts of Mamdani's kind of, social justice campaign, it's going to eventually clash with what Tisch has been doing. And we saw this a little bit with Bill de Blasio, and he kept on, or he had Bill Bratton as his NYPD commissioner, but eventually it was unsustainable because they just disagreed on fundamentals on how to effectively police. And I imagine there's going to be some kind of disagreement, some kind of clash at some point. The question is, who gets more out of this arrangement?
I think Tish, from her vantage point, wants to see whether Mamdani actually means what he says and whether he's going to continue to be pragmatic. If not, this is not going to last very long. It's going to be hard for her to keep the trust of the rank-and-file police if she's having to change her policies and undermine the good work she's been doing over the last several years.
Yeah, I mean, her quote says, "I appreciate the mayor-elect wants a team with different points of view." That says exactly what she knows she's getting into. So another thing is, with Mamdani's election, every socialist is coming out of the woodwork. Axios reports that they expect 30% of Democrats to be primaried by socialists. Now they got a guy trying to primary, I guess his name is Jai Osei, against Hakeem Jeffries. And now Mamdani and AOC go, "Whoa, whoa, whoa, wait a second. We don't want you to primary Hakeem Jeffries. This could be out of control." Listen to this exchange with Mamdani. Cut 7.
"As you've seen, your election has created a lot of buzz. Now that the midterms are underway, that seems to be the focus, but your name is still being dragged into the midterms, right? Let me talk about Hakeem Jeffries for a moment, who now may face a challenge from Chi Osei, who is a member of the DSA. You said that there are local issues that Mr. Osei should be focused on, maybe should remain a councilman. Are you saying he should not run against Hakeem Jeffries?"
"No, I'm saying that I think the focus should be right here on New York City. I respect the work that Councilmember Osei has done in the
council.
But
what does that mean? Should he not run?"
"I think that right now is not the time to be engaging in that kind of a primary. I think the focus should be on delivering on this affordability agenda."
So they're trying to save their guy. I don't think Hakeem Jeffries is a socialist. AOC put Mamdani there. Are they realizing that they might have something? They thought David Hogg was hard to handle. Forget it.
No, Brian, this is an ideological civil war that's going to be taking. It's not just New York, but it's going to the center stage is going to be New York with the primaries coming up next year. Look, I think there a lot of people. There's a function of you have one big win and you think that changes politics. And the reality is, Mamdani, and we've talked about this a lot, Brian. 50% got 50%. They got half the vote. That's not a mandate. That's more, there's definitely a very vocal and notable faction of the Democratic Party that is socialist. About 30, according to the exit polls, 36% of the Democratic vote in New York City was identified as socialist in this mayoral election. So that's a lot. I mean, It's a lot more than we've ever seen before. That said, it's not a majority, and I expect that these challenges to well-established incumbents, certainly Hakeem Jeffries, it's not going to be easy. And Mamdani, I think it's frankly pragmatic politics. I think he knows that someone like Che Osei is probably going to be, you don't want to have your guys lose. And I think Osei would be a pretty likely loser against the potential future speaker or future, certainly current House leader.
So how about this? We'll see what's going to happen on the Democratic side. That's a internal battle that Chuck Schumer doesn't want to fight. Hakeem Jeffries can't figure out. And Mamdani is the most popular right now Democratic politician, Newsom second.
Yeah, get your scorecards out. I mean, but this is you nailed it, Brian. There's at least five or six congressional incumbents, including, you know, Richie Torres in the Bronx and the Jerry Nadler seat. You have a bunch of far left candidates that are running. By the way, that's a district that Cuomo won, and you have people thinking that socialism is the right message and anti-Semitism supporting kind of these anti-Semitic and anti-Israel messages in that district, which is it's the most heavily Jewish district in the entire country. So I think there are people actually don't understand politics. I think there are a lot of people in the socialist camp that are just getting high on their drinking the Kool-Aid, and they think that the Mamdani revolution is taking over New York City. I think they'll see what's coming to them. I think the more important test, though, Brian, is Mamdani's going to have to govern in the meantime before these primaries. So if he governs as the socialist that he campaigned on and the city starts to have issues, if he clashes with Jessica Tisch over policing, if crime goes up, it's not going to – all of a sudden this revolution is not going to look so good politically, even within the Democratic Party. So he's going to have to get results. If things look pretty bad in the first few months of his mayoralty, these candidates are not going to be looking as effective candidates, and it's not going to be the kind of challengers that would be successful. Now, look, if he has a good few months or if he surpasses expectations, who knows? But I think the betting money is more that he's going to hit some turbulence once he takes over.
So Democratic lawmakers, military guys, and one woman put together a tape to warn military people they shouldn't accept illegal orders. Listen to Mark Kelly, Slotkin, Jason Crow. Cut 8.
"This administration is pitting our uniformed military
and intelligence community professionals
against American citizens.
Like us, you all swore an oath
to protect and defend this Constitution.
Right now, the threats to our Constitution aren't just coming from abroad, but from right here at home.
Our laws are clear. You can refuse illegal orders.
You can refuse illegal orders.
You must refuse illegal orders."
So you get the spirit of it. And he won't say what illegal orders. They just say you can refuse illegal orders. You don't like the bombing of these boats in Venezuela. You don't like the operation in Chicago as National Guard. What is the point of this?
Well, it's the point is that they're putting their finger in the wind, and they're seeing that the anti-Trump activism and the growing left-wing nature of the party is what has the momentum. And look, compare Alyssa Slotkin's response to Trump at the State of the Union earlier this year versus the rhetoric now. Compare Jason Crow, if you actually follow where he's supposed to be one of these national security so-called moderates, he's actually voted and said things that, you know, are to the left of a lot of liberals in the House. So these are the national security Democrats, but they are actually seeing where the party's going, and they're trying to jump on that bandwagon. It is a Mark Kelly too. Like, it's a sign of where that energy of the party is. Politicians, by the way, are very reactive figures. It doesn't mean that this is where the country's going, but it means that this is where the energy is. This is where all the activism is right now, and they want to be one of the cool kids. So they're trying to jump on that bandwagon.
But I mean, it's so irresponsible. If you told me the Squad did this or the View talked about this, I go, yeah, no kidding. But that's the hope I have for sanity. That if, you know, the left wings, it's no big deal. It's center left, Joe Manchin. You know, you look at former people that serve, you know, Slotkin, I guess, is CIA, but Jason Crow and Kelly, I've served multiple years, decades. You would think they'd say to themselves, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to make an announcement that people should just disobey orders. And, you know, for example, you don't like the war in Iraq. They're just about done. I'm going to refuse to do a tour. You don't like the bombing of the boats. So I'm going to resign. We're going to call a press conference. That's what they want. They want division.
The reminder right now of where the Democratic Party used to be not that long ago is John Fetterman. He is not engaging. I mean, he's a moderate, but he's not engaging in this, like, you know, move to the left and trying to be with the cool kids in the left wing of the Democratic Party. And now he's out of step with even the people who he used to be allied with on the moderate side of the party. So, I mean, it goes to show just how far to the extreme. I mean, this is where our politics are right now. The middle is collapsing, and even people like Alyssa Slotkin, Mark Kelly, Jason Crow, these are supposedly national security moderates. They are not. I mean, you can even look at the two gubernatorial elects or governor elects in Jersey and Virginia. I mean, they ran pretty cautious campaigns, but they did not, you know, Spanberger on trans issues did not say the kind of things that a lot of Democrats were, the moderate wing of the party, were saying at the very beginning of the year. She tried to avoid the issue entirely. And this is someone who was tagged as a moderate. So, you know, the activists are finding their energy. They're finding that they have the clout right now. And, you know, at the beginning of the year, it was Rahm Emanuel was like the flavor of the month looking to run for president. Now it's AOC. Now it's even these moderates who have national profiles moving well to the left.
I want you to hear what Elon Crane said about that. You know, he's a veteran, former sniper, cut 10.
I thought it was extremely foolish and cowardly at the same time. I thought it was cowardly because if you can't name the unlawful orders that these guys are bringing up, you know, in their video, you know, that just shows me that you don't have the courage to even call out what you're talking about. Number two, I thought it was foolish because if you have to have, you know, a joint statement video like this, and it's the messaging is so bad that reporters have to call your office to ask, what are you even talking about? You look extremely foolish.
And Eli Crane, I'm sure they know exactly where to find him if they don't like those comments.
Yeah, look, I mean, Eli Crane, he's a veteran as well, and from Arizona. So this is right now Trump is at the center. I mean, a lot of it has to do with just national security and how divided the parties are right now. It is kind of remarkable where we are at this moment, but nothing has surprised me much in the last few months.
Hey, Josh, lastly, I believe that this whole Epstein thing, we're going to be talking a week from now, total boomerang. I believe that more Democrats are going to get caught in this, and they're going to try to capture Trump. I don't think they got Trump. I don't think they ever had Trump. I believe that Larry Summers is just the beginning. I know Bill Clinton is not going to like this.
Yeah, I mean, like, you have a member of non-voting member of Congress, and Stacey Plaskett, who was you can't make this stuff up, was texting with Epstein during the 2019 hearing, and he was complimenting her on it. I mean, it was a mutual admiration society from the texts that were leaked. So, I mean, it's actually kind of remarkable that It looked like the Democrats were going to have this unified moment, and then they got this vote. And it turns out that a lot of the backlash has actually transpired. You mentioned Summers, who's lost a lot of his jobs, and looks like he's going to be drummed out of public life. And I think Plaskett, I mean, there's a lot of legs with the Plaskett story, and what exactly she's the representative of the Virgin Islands. So there's a lot more there. They've opened up a can of worms.
They really. It's unbelievable. And we have so much legitimate stuff to talk about. But I do want to bring it up. I was ignoring it for a while, but let's just not ignore it. Josh, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Brian.
All right, so your call's next then. Congressman Brandon Gill, bottom of the hour. Brian Kilmeade Show. We're following it all.
It's Brian Kilmeade. Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
He was that President Trump was a vile creature, the worst thing on the face of the earth. Do you think he's different now than he was in his first term in terms of his abilities, his leadership?
By the way, I said that as a euphemism. I could have done much worse.
you could have done worse. You could have said worse. Are there other adjectives you'd rather use?
No, I want to talk about the House Democrats and how we're going to win.
So she is out of her mind. You have to watch this long form interview. And she is making, I mean, Anderson Cooper doesn't know where she means. She never finishes a sentence or a thought. And she just says the most vile things possible about Trump. She's obsessed. You know why she lost? She's no longer in power. She's going out. He is at his zenith of power. He won two elections, almost won the other election. It wasn't for the first pandemic in five and a half lifetimes. So she can't figure it out. She can't figure it out. She has so much control, but yet she has none. The worst thing I've ever seen in Congress was her ripping up a speech. Can you imagine if someone looked at George W. Bush's speech as he talked about the surge in Iraq, a controversial situation that only maybe 30% of the country supported? Ends up being a brilliant move. And someone behind him, the Speaker of the House, just ripped up his speech. It might have been Nancy Pelosi. Just ripped it up. Crazy. Classless. It's nuts. But thank goodness she's out. And now they're going to pass the Stock Act now that she's gotten so rich off her what seems to be insider training. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. When we come back, Congressman Brandon Gill of Texas. Back in a moment.
Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
We're told that $270 billion in agreements and sales are being signed between dozens of companies, and that's just happening today, $270 billion. That's big stuff. So on behalf of the thousands of American workers who I care about most, I want to thank you for bringing all those jobs and all those great opportunities to America and bring in great wealth to America.
Yeah, that is the President of the United States. Very happy over the last 2 days meeting with MBS, who runs Saudi Arabia, and trying to bring investors in, and a whole bunch of investors, a who's who of this country's wealth, was showed up in order to, I guess, give and take with Saudi Arabia. They want energy. They want RF-35s. They want business opportunities for their people. They want their citizens thinking of entrepreneurship and growth and going into cities and leisure sports and professional sports. And you see it with the soccer leagues. You see it with golf. They're doing it with women's golf now. I think big money's going to flow in. Now, I did see this story in the New York Times that the Saudi Sovereign Wealth Fund, where he's pulling this money out, is depleted. Yeah, I mean, it shows that they've lost a lot of money, some bad investments, bad execution as they try to develop different portions of Saudi Arabia outside Riyadh. Evidently, this place, Nome, I think I'm saying it right, N-E-O-M, they were setting up a utopian village filled with robots to wait on your hand and fist. It's losing money. They also have different investments they can't find a way out of that they call them useless valuations. So some of his deputies, according to 11 separate people, sources in this article, have kind of let him down with their production. So the Sovereign Wealth Fund might be short of cash, which could be problematic because he promised us about $1 trillion. And yesterday, that was on Tuesday. On Wednesday, Saudi Arabia put together $575 billion worth of deals. So maybe it's one of those things where money's flowing in. It's just at this point, it's a trough, and then it's going to be it's going to have a high. The other thing you think, oh, they just pumped their way out of it. Evidently, you can't pump your way out of it because a lot of their regulations are tied up in what you can and can't do because it's a global market and they are the number one oil producer, or we're number one and they're number two, but it's very, very close. So I think it was extremely successful. But what they want in return, what we want in return is Abraham Accords. If they want business, they want Israel. They're an innovation economy, and you got to figure that they would benefit from a financial relationship with Israel, but they got to be confident, careful of their population, who side with the Palestinians in this situation. So it's complicated. Got it. So President was talking about the economy, and he does note that is when it comes to affordability, after the off-year election results, which were terrible for Republicans, that his polls are off just for now. Cut 30.
And we're not going to be successful if we don't allow people that invest billions of dollars in plant and equipment to bring a lot of their people from their country to get that plant open, operating, and working. I'm sorry. So my poll numbers just went down, but with smart people, they've gone way up. They've gone way up. And I mean that. So for those of you that are doing the plants, you're going to have all the help you need, and you're going to do a great job, and you're going to teach our people how to do it.
So what they're going to do is build these plants, and I think originally you're going to have some engineers from that country, you know, Saudi Arabia, and then what you do is you train Americans to take over. So that's the goal. The president gets up every day thinking about how to bring business and jobs back to our country, and then he produces it. Now, it hasn't resulted in an instant jet fuel for the economy, but it will. The polls right now are not great for the president. Fox News polls, for some reason, are never kind to him. I'm not sure why. I don't do the science. 76% of voters view the economy negatively. That's worse than 67% who thought that way in July. 70% said the same as the end of the former Biden administration. Large numbers overall among Republicans say their costs for groceries, utilities, health care, and housing have gone up this year. Voters blame the president Trump twice as much as President Biden for it. Approval of Trump right now handling the economy hits a low. This is totally correctable because everything he does is for the economy. If what's not correctable is foreign policy, that tends to be very slow. But the president's got high foreign policy in relation to his predecessors at 43%. That is higher than, I think, 32% for George Bush at this point, and 34%, not at George Bush, but for Barack Obama and Joe Biden. But the president's foreign policy has been flat out brilliant. Now there's calls in Venezuela for Maduro to step by Colombia. Says, why doesn't Maduro or Venezuela just step out? That's what this is about. Not bombing Venezuela, showing the power that shows you can't win. When we come back, we hope to catch up with Congressman Brandon Gill. Boom. Don't move.
Giving you everything you need to know. You're with Brian Kilmeade. The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, welcome back, everyone. Joining me now is Congressman Brandon Gill of Texas, Judiciary Budget Oversight Committee. Busy guy, always willing to do an interview. Would always appreciate it. Congressman, welcome back.
Brian, thanks for having me.
Hey, Brandon, first off, could you give everyone an idea what happened with this Trump-appointed judge in your state that said you cannot use the redistricting lines for the midterm elections and where it goes from here?
Yeah, well, listen, what I'll say is I would expect this to probably go to the Supreme Court. We'll see how they rule. This is something that always happens at the state level, not the federal level, in terms of Congress. So it's not something that U.S. congressmen have been involved in, but I think the courts are going to have a say in this.
But does it make you worry about holding the majority if this holds up?
You know, it's something we're definitely following this really closely. I mean, we're going to fight to keep the majority regardless of how the courts rule. But this is an important case for us, for sure.
Speaking of judges, you're looking to move on impeachment of Judge Boasberg. Tell us what he's done and what alerted you to the fact that he's not fit to wear that robe.
Sure. So if you remember the Arctic Frost investigation, this was the weaponized politicization of the Justice Department under Merrick Garland, where Mar-a-Lago was raided, where you have President Trump's cell phone seized, Vice President Pence's cell phone seized. Same with Representative Scott Perry. This was the dragnet operation of Democrats looking to go after any Republican, any conservative who was political opposition at the time. Well, during that widespread investigation, Judge Boasberg signed off on non-disclosure orders, saying that sitting United States senators were not to know that their cell data and their mobile data was being monitored by the FBI at the time. I think that is an egregious abuse of power. It's a violation of the separation of powers, of course, and it's a politicization of the courts. He ought to be impeached for it. What he did is, what happened was, Senator Cruz, I'll use him as an example, sitting United States senator, under this Arctic Frost investigation, his mobile records were being monitored by the FBI while he was a sitting U.S. senator, and this judge stepped in, signed a non-disclosure order demanding that those carriers not tell him that that was happening. And the logic that he gave was that if Senator Cruz knew that his data was being monitored, he would tamper with evidence and he would intimidate witnesses. There was no basis whatsoever to make that determination, again, of a sitting United States senator. I mean, this is so far beyond the pale. This man has no business being on any court, much less in the federal judiciary.
Congressman, let's talk about what's happening tomorrow. Zohran Mamdani has been invited to the White House after he asked for that invitation. He wants to talk to the president. Here he is describing what led to this meeting. Cut one.
We did reach out to the White House, and my team reached out because of a commitment that I made to New Yorkers, that I would be willing to meet with anyone and everyone so long as it was to the benefit of the 8.5 million people who call the city home and their struggle to afford the most expensive city in the United States of America.
So how do you think this is going to go?
Well, I'm glad that he is willing to sit down with President Trump. Listen, what Mamdani has proposed for New York, as we know, is absolutely, or will be absolutely catastrophic, you know, defunding the police, not working with federal immigration authorities as a matter of policy. I mean, he's going to take New York down a very, very dark path. So I'm glad to hear that he's meeting with the president. I'm very curious to see how that goes.
I hope they open up the cameras. I hope they let the press in, and then we'll see some exchanges. Because this guy's not backing off a lot of his opinions, including they got an elite unit for special circumstances, like what happened when the NFL building was infiltrated by the gunman, and when that elite unit took him down. He wants to disband that. He's not backing off from that. He also wants to not add any cops to New York City. I don't know if you've been here before, but we need 6,000 more cops. So I just don't know how this philosophy, now they say in Congress, in the House, they expect 30 Democrats to be primaried by socialists. Have you talked to your Democratic colleagues? Do they have a concern here?
You know, I think the reality is there's only a handful of moderate Democrats left. You know, the Democrat Party used to be the party where you had several dozen what they called blue dog Democrats, and they were relatively conservative Democrats who could work across the aisle with Republicans on certain issues. You know, they weren't communists. They weren't socialists. Yeah. They weren't radical, transgender activists by any means. I mean, the reality is that the Democrat Party of the Blue Dogs is totally dead, and it's being replaced by Mamdani, the communist mayor out in Seattle as well. You know, the party, I think that's a big reason why Nancy Pelosi is deciding now's the time for her to bow out, because this is not the party that she controlled for so long. And listen, Nancy Pelosi was a far left Democrat. I mean, she pushed the House as far to the left as she possibly could. But the new party that is emerging under Mamdani being one of the core leaders, it is so un-American. It is so contrary to our nation's cultural history. And, you know, the reality is, if we're being very honest, that Mamdani's presence in the United States, his parents' presence in the United States, is a damning indictment of our legal immigration system. This is somebody who never should have come into our country at all.
Why do you say that?
Hate this
Why
country.
Do you say that, Congressman?
They hate this country. They've talked about how suicide bomb, his father, for instance, who is a professor at Columbia, has written about how suicide bombing is a legitimate form of military operations. I mean, these are people who hate this country. They hate the values that our country was founded on. And we shouldn't be letting people like that into our country to begin with.
Well, here you go. And I know there's a lot of people who are coming to here and over in Europe that have no interest in their countries. They just want a better life to live their culture in another country. We have to figure out some type of screening process for that. So I was stunned. If you told me that there was a tape out there that's addressing the military, asking them to disobey orders that they don't like, I would think, well, that's something on The View. Well, that's something that the squad put out. But instead, you have decorated veterans like Mark Kelly and Jason Crow and CIA, former CIA operative Alyssa Slotkin, turned senator, say this, cut eight.
This administration is pitting our uniformed military
and intelligence community professionals
against American citizens.
Like us, you all swore an oath
to protect and defend this Constitution.
And right now, the threats to our Constitution aren't just coming from abroad, but from right here at home.
So you hear this. This is borderline treason. They're starting to, Todd Blanche is looking into investigating what's behind this. They will not tell us what exactly they want. They want the National Guard to turn on Border Patrol. Do they want the Venezuelan drug boat strikes to stop? What are they doing here?
You know, all this is that Democrats, their leadership is Mamdani, and they have no real compelling message that the American people agree with. So it's no matter what, whatever the president's doing, they're going to stand in opposition to it. I mean, I sit in committee hearings, whether it's on judiciary or oversight, where you have Democrats as part of an official committee hearing referring to ICE agents as Nazis and the Gestapo. I mean, this is so, so far beyond the pale. And now they're actually directing military leaders and people associated who are working in immigration authorities to disobey their orders. I mean, that is so un-American. But you're right. That is borderline treason. And it's incredibly dangerous.
So I want you to hear what Todd Blanche said last night. As you know, he's Deputy Attorney General, Cut 11.
Well, the investigation would absolutely be under what their intent was in saying this. And the question, we've all watched this a lot today, and the question you have to ask yourself is, what is their intent? What is the reason that they all went on a video and encouraged young men and women to defy court orders without even giving a hint of what's illegal, without even giving any suggestion of what law or what order they're being asked to violate? You cannot do that in this country, especially if you're a leader. And so what does the investigation look like? I think they should be held to account. I think that those congressmen should be required to answer questions and to answer questions about why they did what they did. And the American people deserve that, and so does President Trump.
I'd like to hear the explanation, because it was something scripted. It was well edited. I don't know who funded it, whose idea it was. I know you could find out.
Well, I can tell you the answer is actually quite simple why they're pushing this. You know, you saw under the Biden administration, open borders, 10 million plus people flood across into our country from God knows where. And that was a deliberate policy decision from the Biden administration and from Democrats to bring in as many illegal aliens as possible. And they're doing it because they know that it politically benefits them. The presence of illegal aliens in the United States impacts congressional apportionment, meaning the number of congressmen that each state is allotted. And it tends to benefit blue states at the expense of red. They also know that in many states across the country, there's very little election security, no voter ID laws, things like that, that allow illegal aliens to vote right now. So this is all part of a broader political plan from the Democrats, incredibly cynical, incredibly dark, to systematically rig our political elections in their favor by importing voters. And it's happening, and it is still their plan. This is something the American people rejected resoundingly last November, and yet they're still trying to do it again because they know that is how they can hold on to power.
You know what? The thing is, though, I am personally disappointed because I always look for military men, especially accomplished officers, to have that red, white, and blue pride. This is all about division. They're not trying to make the military better. They're trying to hurt the Secretary of War and the President, in my view. And I'm personally outraged by it because I expected more. I expect nothing from the squad, but I expect more from guys like this. And Alyssa Slotkin, who characterizes herself as a moderate. Not anymore. Sorry. Lastly, I think the Epstein files is going to be the ultimate boomerang. I'm looking at all the people attached that are coming up in the paperwork we already got. They're trying to get Trump. They're blowing each other up. Now I'm seeing all these, Bill Gates is back in the news again. It looks like he was being extorted by Epstein because he's having an affair on his own. Now that's out. Larry Summers jumping out of public display. The Virgin Islands representative. I don't know how she could even walk back into Congress again. How do you feel this is all going to play out?
Well, you know, I think you're exactly right. As you know, Democrats could care less about the Epstein files whenever Biden was in office. And you know as well as I do that if President Trump was in there, which he's not, this would have come out 10 years ago. The Democrats have been throwing everything they possibly could to destroy the president. He's not in the files. I don't think that he is. But you're right. We're finding out more and more, including a sitting United States congresswoman, a delegate from the Virgin Islands, who was texting Jeffrey Epstein during a congressional hearing to get his advice on the types of questions she should be asking. I mean, that is astounding. I think she ought to be censured. I think we're going to have a vote on that. We had a vote on that earlier this week. Unfortunately, we weren't able to get it through. But I mean, this is going to come back and hit them, because Jeffrey Epstein, he did cavort with a lot of very powerful Democrats.
And a lot of business people, a lot of bankers, and Hakeem Jeffries. Evidently, they were solicited to contribute to Hakeem Jeffries' account. I love that explanation. Congressman Brandon Gill, you're off to a great start in Congress. Hope you can have continued success. Thanks so much for joining us.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
All right. Listen, we're at the top of the hour. Don't forget, What Made America Great on Fox Nation. 5 new episodes. You'll love it. Everything from the Battle of Gettysburg to the crossing of the Delaware River. Don't move.
This is Ainsley Earhart. Thank you for joining me for the 52-episode podcast series, The Life of Jesus.
A listening experience that will provide hope, comfort, and understanding of the greatest story ever told. Listen and follow starting November 30th on FoxNewsPodcasts.com.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're there. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. Moving you through an exciting Thursday. Got jobs numbers real good. The market loves it. Up there 380 points. Was up as much as 500 points. They added 119,000 jobs. They thought they were going to add 50, so they always get a good surprise. But the numbers are a mystery. You know, we were flying blind with the lockout, the shutdown. But this hour, we're going to talk with Brian Stile, the congressman from Wisconsin. We're also going to talk to Senator Rick Scott about health care. And John O'Hurley, the actor, author, comedian, game show host. He does everything. You know him from Seinfeld and now the National Dog Show, everything. So we'll end with some fun. So there's a lot going on in Washington today on healthcare, as well as a stock deal that I think is way overdue. It's called the Stock Act. Don't move. Let's get to the big three.
Number three.
I believe that Jeffrey Epstein had information and I was going to get information. You get information from people where you can. I've interviewed narcotics, drug traffickers, and others, and that doesn't mean that I'm their friend.
But it means that you're not telling the truth. Jeffrey Epstein has your phone number, and he was texting you during a hearing about Donald Trump. Boomerang. The Epstein files begin to leak out, and to Dems are now front and center. Why I think more than just disgraced Harvard Obama Clinton official Larry Summers is going to pay the price here.
Number two.
This administration is pitting our uniformed military
and intelligence community professionals
against American citizens.
You can refuse illegal orders.
You must refuse illegal orders.
It's treasonous. The Democratic vets show their radical side by putting out a message to the military that, in my view, borders on treason. The blowback is just beginning.
Number one.
We did reach out to the White House, and my team reached out because of a commitment that I made to New Yorkers, that I would be willing to meet with anyone and everyone so long as it was to the benefit of the 8.5 million people who call the city home and their struggle to afford the most expensive city in the United States of America.
Yep, there we go. Guess who's coming for lunch? Zohran Ramdani coming to visit President Trump tomorrow. Let's see if the odd couple will survive multiple seasons. I think it's going to be a lot of friction, but maybe they'll be nice tomorrow. Hopefully the press will get a chance to talk. Let's bring in Congressman Brian Stile. Hey, Congressman, welcome.
Thanks for having me on.
First off, the Stock Act. What's in it, and why is it taking so long to get it passed or on the floor?
Well, we had our hearing yesterday. I think that's a huge step forward. We haven't had a hearing on this in Washington in way too long. And what we are doing is moving forward to make sure that we actually get this into law. What's the principle? That no member should come to Washington and financially benefit off of insider information. And if we look back at how the Stock Act performed since it was put into law 13 years ago, I think everyone knows that there's a real opportunity here to make real substantive and dramatic improvements. If you want to go and trade stocks for a living, there's a place to do that. It's called Wall Street. If you want to come to Washington, to Capitol Hill, you should be here to drive forward an America First agenda. and get this country back on track. You should not be engaged to make a living on trading stocks.
So what do you do if you have a successful business career? You know, you're on Wall Street, you decide you want to run for office, right? That's how you made your money. Day traders said to say they want to serve. They win an election. What should they do?
Well, that's the exact question and why we want to make sure that we get this right, that we close out loopholes, but we also give an avenue for people that have had a successful career in the private sector that they can still come to Washington. But what we have seen time and again is some individuals come to Washington and then leverage inside information to their financial benefit. We've seen members of Congress that have gone to jail and been convicted of insider trading. We had the former Senate intelligence chair call their broker in the days before the COVID pandemic became fully understood by the American people, and he sold all but one share of stock in his entire portfolio. And so we have to make sure that we get this right, that we give an avenue for people that have been successful in the private sector to still be able to come to Congress. We need more business people in Congress, in my opinion. But we also have to remove the bad actors, those individuals that think they're coming to Washington to simply make trades on inside information to profit them and their family.
So, you know, it's pretty insidious. How about Nancy Pelosi? They estimate she made $130 million during her time in Congress. That's a 16,930% return. She did not want this act passed, but now that she's leaving, she's going to support it. She's going to get away with this?
Well, I mean, this is exactly why we need this legislation, to provide confidence in the American people that members of Congress aren't enriching themselves off of illegal trades. One of the things we talked about at yesterday's hearing was how the Stock Act requires reportings in increments. So it's actually really difficult for the American people to get a full understanding of exactly what trades are taking place. And the reports come 45 days after. And so we have a huge opportunity to revise and amend this law to make sure that we're instilling confidence from the American people that members of Congress aren't enriching themselves, and to truly prevent members of Congress from being able to leverage inside information for their own financial benefit.
So where's it at? You had your hearings. What are your colleagues saying? There's reports that you're getting pushback on both sides of the aisle. Or do you think I'm just going back prior to your hearing? Do you think after your hearing, do you think you'll have the votes?
Well, we completed the hearing. We're in the process of soliciting feedback and information from folks, give them a window to provide that to us. And then what I want to do is not simply write a good piece of legislation on paper. I want to get this passed. I want to get it through the House of Representatives, get 218 votes, and get it across the line in the Senate. We've seen a number of people put forward ideas and suggestions in this space, but fail to get it across the line. My goal is not only to come out with a good piece of legislation, but to be in a position to actually garner the support in the House and the Senate, because I think the American people know that we need to get this done, but don't let logic get in the way of understanding how Congress operates. And so we have a huge opportunity here. We need to get this across the line. The hearing yesterday was a good and positive first step.
So, okay, we'll see where it goes. Do you think you have any word from the Senate if they'll take it up?
Well, I think if we get the legislation right and we pass this in an overwhelming fashion in the House, we can force the Senate to act on this. We've seen legislation come before the Senate and fail before. But that said, 13 years ago, the Stock Act passed both the House and the Senate. It's when we get this right, we have the window to do it, build the public support. We know the public supports this. And as we come forward, we're going to have a real opportunity to ultimately get this across the line. Part of the Trump agenda, drain the swamp. This is an absolutely essential piece of that puzzle.
Do you think that 401ks that you usually get from your job and pension plans, do you think they should be? What do you do with that if you walk into, if you walk in with a 401k, which many congressmen and women will have? What do they do?
Well, this is exactly why getting a legislation right rather than simple is so important. When individuals have diversified portfolios, the likelihood and the risk is significantly lower. And so we're looking at that. There's about 7,000 ETFs, these, you know, financial instruments that are trading based on stocks. We have to make sure that we get all of this right, because the concern is that if we don't, members will use a loophole to financially benefit themselves. But again, individuals that had successful private sector careers, maybe are later in their career and have that 401k, a pension plan, funds that they've saved up maybe for their child's education, we want to make sure that those members can still come to Congress as well. And so that's what we're digesting. We're trying to get this right. And I think we got a real opportunity to do just that.
So there's a poll out by Fox, and it says, when it comes to what party's doing what on the major issues, you guys are plus 29 on border, illegal immigrants, plus 16, reducing crime, plus 14, reducing budget deficit, plus 5. But making things affordable, you're down 10. Raising wages, you're down 14. And then reducing health care costs, you're down 21. Is that how do you work on those numbers? And if you don't you agree that you're going to have trouble in the midterms?
Well, we have to work on affordability, and I think we are. The Biden administration made things so bad that you can't immediately flip a switch and make life more affordable, but we can make real and substantive progress. And I think as Republicans, we have to talk more about that, about what we're doing to lower costs for families. And in particular, grocery costs, lowering energy costs is a key driver. If you're from Wisconsin like I am, you know that it's a diesel tractor that's in the field. It's a diesel truck that's bringing that to the grocery store. And keeping your cold milk in that fridge is electricity that's often powered by coal or natural gas. The energy policies of the Trump administration, driven forward by Republicans in Congress and in the Senate, will ultimately lower your grocery costs. But flipping the switch, it's not as easy as that when you had four absolutely destructive years of the Biden administration of putting massive amounts of money into this economy by giving away money and paying people not to work, energy policies that were absolutely horrific. And so we are beginning to turn the tide on this. We got to talk more about the efforts and the work that's being done to make life more affordable. The inflation rate has come down, but it is not all the way down to a spot where life is affordable yet. We have to continue this work.
All right, Congressman Brian Stile, best of luck. Thanks so much. First step taken.
Thank you.
All right, we'll talk about the other hot issue, and that's health care with Rick Scott. He spent his career, great success with it. Now he wants to help Congress. Will it work? Don't move.
Don't go anywhere. Brian Kilmeade will be right back. The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
We're having a Senate Finance Committee hearing, and we'll hear about the situation. But let's elaborate on the president's plan. We have $26 billion available, if you will, for what Joe Biden put in as enhanced premium tax credits. The Democrats want to send that $26 billion back to the insurance companies. They take 20% of that for profit and overhead. That's law under Obamacare. They're allowed to take that 20%.
So that is Senator Dr. Bill Cassidy trying to get something done at the hearings yesterday. And they're trying to solve a problem quickly. Is it possible? He's an expert in his field as a doctor. And also when it comes to running hospitals and healthcare, before Rick Scott was a senator and a governor, that's what he did. And that's who he was, very successful. So Senator Rick Scott, what could you tell everybody is you're offering or working on to help with his, to help save Obamacare or fix Obamacare or come up with an alternative?
Well, first off, Brian, I want to make sure people actually get health care. I grew up in a family. I grew up in public housing, never met my natural dad. And my mom had struggled to put food on the table and get health care for us. My little brother had a disease, and we couldn't find somebody in our city to take care of him for free because she had no money. She had to go to a charity hospital 4 hours away. That shouldn't happen. So let's make sure people have access to health care. Obamacare had these promises. You keep your doctor a lie, keep your plan a lie, you're going to save $2,500 a family. Complete lie. What's happened is the cost of healthcare has skyrocketed. Deductibles, co-payments, everything has gone skyrocketed. And under Obamacare, we're sending all this money to insurance companies. Guess what? Let's give it to the individual. Let them be a buyer, like they buy food or they buy a car or they buy gas. And let them make choices. So what I want to do is take the money under the original Obamacare that covers people up to 400% of poverty and say, whatever money you're going to get under that plan, we're going to give it to you in the form of an HSA that you can start buying. Maybe you want to, you can go negotiate with your doctor or your hospital, or you can pay your co-payments or your premiums. And then let insurance companies sell whatever they want to sell to you as long as it's approved by state administrators. So we cover people with pre-existing condition. We give people options. It's going to drive down the cost of health care and make people a consumer of health care.
Right. So how did it go yesterday when you deal with Democrats? Because you need a bipartisan solution or else you guys are just going to tear up whatever the other side does. So what was it like? Are people trying to get something done?
Oh, I've talked to a lot of Democrats, and they acknowledge the cost of Obamacare, the cost of health care is way too high, right? And so, you know, I'm going to put a bill out that's going to do the things I just talked about, create transparency for the consumer, and I'm going to work to get Democrats. It's going to happen because what we're doing does not work. So whether we get it done in December or whether we get it done in 2 years, this is the only way. You know, the consumer making choices is the only.
But is there a sense of urgency, Senator, to get something done? I mean, I saw Senator Cassidy said on Sunday, and I talked to him on yesterday on the show. He really wants to get something done, and he says there's some people on the other side that want to get something done. So, if this plan, if the subsidies come and just go into a different account, I don't know that Democrats love insurance companies. That's not really what they've ever said in the past, but they are getting the money. So, I imagine there wouldn't be some inherent pushback on what you just said.
Well, first off, the Biden COVID subsidies, think about this. Each of the parents making $20,000 a year, they're subsidizing people to make $250,000 a year. They could be millionaires, right? I'm not going to do that, right? I'm not for extending the Biden COVID. I want to go back to the normal Obamacare, all right, and say, let's help these people, you know, up to 400%. So, where I live in Naples.
So, you got to get rid of some of the people that are overqualified, that the 400% over the poverty line.
Yeah.
Forget them. And
I think the number is
10% of the people are overqualified, so they're not, so they shouldn't be getting it. So, with that 10% gone, what do you do?
It's people that are making $250,000 a year. And by the way, there's between 4 and 6 million people that didn't even know they had these COVID subsidies, because all you had to do to set them up was know the person's name, their birth date, and their address, and they could set them up. And so money went directly to the insurance company, and the individual, it was a pure profit because the individual didn't even know they had coverage. It's got to stop. It's just complete fraud.
No, but you need transparency,
what
people are paying for, so you know what hospital to go to. Hey, this hospital gouges me. You want freedom of choice. But in the short term, you guys, I know, want to be successful in the midterm elections. And on health care, you're getting hammered. You're down like 22 points in the last Fox poll. If you could do something to fix health care on the fly and with a permanent fix down the pike, I think that would really help your fortunes next year.
Well, I've been focused on this. I mean, I fought Hillary Care, and so I got investigated by the federal government because I know that Hillary Care was a disaster. Obamacare has been a disaster. I want consumer care. To stop this top-down government deciding things for you, insurance company deciding for you, you get to decide. You get to spend this money. That's how you fix it. That's how you get costs down. If we do a bunch of patchwork things, we're not going to fix it. The prices are not going to come down.
So what do you want to accomplish out of these hearings? Like, what do you want to accomplish in December and January?
What I want to do is I want to pass – I've got a bill I'll be dropping hopefully today that's going to say if we subsidize you, the federal government subsidizes you, it goes into an HSA, you start being the buyer of health care, and you shouldn't be told by the federal government – what healthcare plan you should have to buy. You should get to decide that. Americans
okay,
are
well,
smart.
I know.
They
that's
know
similar to
family.
Cassie. So how many votes do you think you have?
I'm optimistic we can get this passed.
Okay. And
so
then have you talked to
yet.
Anyone in the House?
Yeah, I talk to my friends in the House all the time. And so I had dinner last night I have dinners on Wednesday night with the Freedom Caucus in the House. And so they want to fix health care, too. We all do. I mean, every Republican I know wants people like me. They want people to get health care. I want people to really get health care. But this Obamacare, we have $10,000 deductibles. People aren't getting health care with that.
Yeah, $6,000 to $10,000 deductibles doesn't work. All the major companies have bowed out of it. Cigna, Aetna, United. Yeah. They're not on the exchanges. So it's all falling apart. But I just worry about the people listening that may or may not have voted for you, or just saying, I just need some help here.
I'm going to do everything I can to get people, actually get them health care and get the cost of health care down. That's what they need. They don't need another government program that's not going to last.
Gotcha. Senator Rick Scott, I look forward to your bill, and then we'll see how it moves forward. And I know you know how to explain it, because this is what you did for a living. Thanks so much, Senator. Appreciate it.
See you, Brian. Bye-bye.
All right. Back in a moment. We come back. John O'Hurley joins us. It's going to be great. He's going to be in studio. And don't forget what made America great.
He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
So we're back in studio with the great John O'Hurley, actor, author, comedian, game show host. And now he's going to focus on many jobs. Host of the National Dog Show, you know. It's a Thanksgiving Day tradition that airs on NBC right after the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade. It's the 23rd annual dog show. How many have you done, John?
24th, actually. Yeah, this is our 24th year.
It's 24th year.
I've been there ever since the beginning.
Wow. And how has it grown?
Exponentially. We had the first year that we did the show back in 2002, we have, to everybody's surprise, we did about 19 million people. Today, we're up around 30 million. And every year it grows and grows and grows and grows. So as the rest of television is trying to find an audience, ours just, all you have to do is put the cameras on the puppy's eyes and that's it.
How do you explain it? How do you explain the growth in popularity?
I cannot for the life of
me. It's not like the dogs are new.
No, it isn't. But it's just that I think people, whether you're 4 or you're 94, there's something there for you. And everybody can sit down and watch, and it's something everybody agrees on. It's not as regional as football would be. And I think it just satisfies an audience that's yearning for something gentle and universal.
Well, and you love doing it.
Oh, I love doing it. It's just so much fun. I mean, there's 2,000 dogs. There are 2,000 of the top dogs in the country. They've all been champions at one point during the year. So you're seeing the best of the best. It really is so enjoyable. And it's the last bench show, which means that all of the dogs have to remain during the show with the owners and the handlers and what have you. So it's a very educational experience.
Have you met with any of these dogs yet?
Oh, sure. I interview them all the time. And right. You know what? Not one answers me back.
It's so weird. What about the owners?
They are exactly as you would think. This is their life. And if you go out into the parking lot out there, you'll see hundreds of these full bus RVs out there, and this is their life. They go from show to show to show to show, and they see everybody. They know everybody backstage. The dogs all know each other. It's a wonderful community.
Wait a second. The dogs all know each other?
Oh, sure. They all sniff. They all sniff around up there. That's what they do. I will tell you something, and I want you to understand this, and I'm telling you something that only the experts realize. The dogs don't care who wins.
Are you sure?
I'm sure. I'm absolutely sure. I've looked at these. Now, this is 24 years of experience that brought me to this point.
They don't know that they won.
No, there is an adrenaline rush, I will say. The dogs, as they enter the ring, it's like all of a sudden everybody's applauding and they respond
feel
that. Yeah, they respond to that. Yeah.
So you have 1,800 of the nation's top dogs spanning over 190 breeds. What I'm amazed at, are we still coming up with breeds?
We are every year. This year we have the Swedish-Danish farm dog. I don't know how I don't know how they came up with that name, but I'm guessing it's from Sweden and from Denmark.
And so, in other words, it's a mutt.
It would look like a generic dog until you realize the darn thing was bred for just about anything you can do on a farm. And they have they're small dogs, but they have a heart of a Sherman tank. You can't stop them from, if they have a mindset to do something, they do it. And they're bred to be hunters, herders, ratters. Remember the halcyon days of ratting?
Right.
Yeah, we don't do that much anymore.
We used to have dogs eat rats?
Yeah, we had, that's what the terriers are for. The terriers go down the hole to grab the vermin.
Because there is a breed called the rat terrier.
The rat terrier, yeah.
And
yeah.
That's really what it's for?
That's what it's for. But also all the other terriers are for that too. And that's why I have the little stubby tails. You pull them out of the hole by the tail.
Wow. I did not know all this, but you do have to know what you're doing.
Well, over a period of time, you learn a lot. I've been very lucky to have David Fry, the most knowledgeable man in the world of dogs, at my side. So all I have to do is defer to him if I don't.
Madison Square Garden.
No, we're the Kennel Club of Philadelphia. So we shoot the show at the Greater Philly Expo Center out in.
Did you used to do at the Garden?
No. No, that was Westminster that was there, and then they've been kind of jumping around trying to find a home.
Right, because they don't have it.
They don't have it. We have it. As I say, we've got 30 million people that watch us, so it's we're in good shape.
So you're out in L.A.?
Yeah, I live out in L.A., in Lollaville.
I was just talking to Gary Sinise. He moved out to Tennessee. You talk to these comedians, they're moving out.
Yeah.
I lived there for a while. It's always been the goal for so many people to get out to L.A. It's exciting.
It is.
Yeah. You're still there.
I'm still there, and I'm reluctantly there. And we are most of it was the fact that we had our son in school out there.
Yeah.
He's now at Baylor in aviation and in his freshman year, so we now are scratching our heads going, there's got to be somewhere else.
But you know your neighbors. You love the climate.
We kind of mildly know our neighbors, and that's one of the reasons out there. You know, Californians, you know, we lived on a street in Beverly Hills for and Jack Black was my next-door neighbor, and darn if I ever saw him.
Really?
Yeah, no, we lived on the same street, you know, probably exchanged the same mail that was erroneously delivered, and but that was the only time I ever saw him.
So you don't have that sense of community over in?
No, not at all. I mean, I would love to, but it's not that we're against it, but you just don't out there.
There's a documentary out now about how slow the rebuild's been since the Pacific Palisades.
Absolutely.
And this is the rich of the rich.
Inexcusably awful. Yes, it is. Well, a lot of the problems have been that they won't grandfather, and they will no longer grandfather the sewer systems in. A lot of those homes out in Malibu and Palisades had old grandfathered in sewer systems, that won't happen anymore. So you're spending $3 million before you even get to the surface.
And do you think a lot of people are walking away?
They're going to have to. Yeah, there's just no way that they can rebuild with the insurance money that they're being given, if they're being given at all. Remember, 1,200 policies were canceled about a month before.
Because the insurance thing doesn't balance out for the companies.
No, it doesn't. And you don't know how this little circle is going to end.
And the thing is, too, it's about the free market. We have this mayor-elect that thinks socialism is the answer. Mm. When you cap things, people will take action. If you're going to cap how much rent I could have, I'm going to keep that apartment empty.
Exactly.
We have hundreds of thousands of apartments empty here. So if you're going to cap how much insurance companies can charge, they're going to go, okay, I won't do business here.
Yeah.
Because not that they're being mean. Oh, I imagine insurance companies are in it. A lot of them publicly traded.
Yep.
I have to make a profit. How do I make sense of that?
Yeah. It's not possible.
I have employees.
Yeah. It's not possible, and it's a conundrum that's going to have to be fixed, because you can't have that type of land sitting out there overlooking the ocean and not doing something with it.
So here's the thing that I find so interesting, because I remember I lost lost everything, and I was in Malibu, living in the bottom of a house, burned to the ground, lost everything. But the good news is I had a little.
I remember that. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then you had Sandy. We had 3 feet of water. Most of my neighborhood was just flooded. So I know what it's like. Some people have money, doesn't have money. It doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
When you get flooded, fires, whatever, you're pretty much at ground zero, depending on how you're prepared. But my thing is, when you have this many powerful people frustrated, even if they have the resources, they can't build because they got to get employees and permits. Then I'm wondering, is that going to get through to their heads that this isn't a Republican or Democrat thing, that this is not helping people?
Exactly. That's all I can say to it is exactly.
Yeah, I don't want to get you in trouble.
No. Yeah. It's not a question of getting in trouble. It's a question of absolutely
agreeing
with you. We are... It is a conundrum out there. The slowness of the permits that they said were never going to happen. Well, there's only half a dozen permits been issued.
Mm-hmm. So when you talk about things being shot in L.A., do you no longer have to – if in your business, do you no longer have to be there? Because there's so much outside
I'm coming to the point where I really am realizing I don't need to be. A lot of the work that I do is voice work. A lot of it I can fly in for. I did 5 movies this year. I didn't do a single one of them in Los Angeles.
Really?
Yeah. Not a single one of them in Los
Angeles. Can I ask you where you are?
All over. I was down in Atlanta, in Tennessee. Then I was in New York City. And then a couple of others that I don't remember where I was.
But it's not there.
Huh?
And what also, do you think that even though the whole wokeness really started in L.A. when everyone wanted to be politically correct, but I think that they were one of the first to pay the price when you can't get a key grip and let's say they're a half Cuban with who are gender confused with a limp. So
it's also the Academy Awards demand now that you check all these boxes or you cannot be nominated for an Academy Award. It's absolutely silly.
But do you find that people become less political when they realize how it's hurting their occupation?
Yes and no. There still is people willing to walk into walls out there to protect the diversity. And I just don't get it. I don't get it. But I will say that as a white man at my age, it's difficult to work out there. There's no question about it.
And much more difficult than when you broke in.
Oh, my goodness. Absolutely. It's like night and day.
So the whole meritocracy that was so much a part of acting and performing and singing and the meritocracy, I think in many ways, acting is fundamentally that if you're good, I don't care who you know.
Mm-hmm.
And if you know everybody and you're not good, unless the Scorsese thing and his kid was a different story. But it's really about performance and execution. And you're saying they've lost that.
Yeah, it has been. A lot of this has been funneled into making sure that it's we're checking boxes rather than putting the best people on stage for their talent.
Wow. Yeah. When you go to airports, most people think Peterman.
Absolutely.
Are you okay with that?
Oh, no, absolutely. Listen, the day that I complain about somebody recognizing me as Jay Peterman is the day the music dies.
Right.
You know, it was one of the great, most enjoyable things I ever had the privilege of doing and the greatest cast that I ever could have been partnered up with. And, you know, we have a new audience today because courtesy of Netflix, they bought the series and now we have binge watching 14 to 20 year olds watching the show for the first time.
How many have you seen?
Oh, I've seen them all. I've seen them all, but I didn't watch it first run. I would not watch it because I was so frustrated by the way the show was edited. And I, you know, they would always have these long, monotonous Peterman monologues in every show that would, you know, he would go out there, take a right hand turn and never come back. And I enjoyed those so much, but then, you know, you watch the show and it's not there because the show was too long. So we always had to trim the Peterman monologue that was the first to go. Very frustrating.
How do you handle that?
I was just realize that, you know, you're blessed to be working there and have the best time you can and just try to remember.
But that is
I remember all the monologues, let me put it that way, some 30 years later.
What is your technique for memorizing stuff like that?
I start with the verbs. You start with the verbs and then go to the subject. Look for the activity that each sentence is expressing and then look for the who's doing it.
And then do people at that level, I know writers are particular, but so you got this, you got the monologue, you got it, you go to read it, you think I'd rather say it this way. And you don't check with it, but you just do it your way.
Yeah.
Do you find people, even though you're writing it, do it again?
It depends. Now, Seinfeld was the type of
That's
thing.
That's what
that,
I mean, Seinfeld.
Seinfeld was the type of show that if you could think of a funnier way to do it, try it. Try it. If it works, it's in the script. Nobody has any ego about, you know, you're killing my line.
Curb Your Enthusiasm, famously, they say they ad-lib a lot of it. Like they go in there and they
You can tell that that's all just stream of consciousness. And it's here's what we want to accomplish in the scene. And they're bullet points. And so that's what they
do. Did you do that in Seinfeld?
No. Seinfeld was tightly scripted. But you had the entire week of rehearsals to arrive at the point where you could have it tightly scripted. Comedy is better when it's tightly scripted because there's a flow to the line. Elaine, do you have any idea what happens to a butter-based frosting after 6 decades in a poorly ventilated British basement? I have a feeling what you are about to go through will be punishment enough. But you see, there's a cadence to it.
Your cadence. Especially.
Well, it is. It's my cadence, but it's but there's. That only works if it's tightly scripted.
Do you think that there'll be a comeback for the sitcom?
For the sitcom, yes. For Seinfeld, no. No,
oh, I know that. Yeah,
we were selfish 30-year-olds. I don't think selfish 60-year-olds makes a great fodder for comedy.
I just thought that was so interesting, and I think I might have brought this up to you before. I remember like Cheers and Taxi. They would have characters that you like, flawed but liked. Mm-hmm. Seinfeld made it clear, and I've never met him, but Simon and Clifford, I don't want you to like these guys.
Mm-hmm. We were not nice people and would sell each other out in a second if the opportunity struck.
Right. Yeah. So how do you explain it? It's just funny's funny? Is that it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because
here was the thing. I remember getting up out of my chair after the first read-through of Peterman introducing himself to the show. And I called my manager and I said, this is the number one show on television. It's not funny. And he said, just be.
Had you seen it before?
No, I hadn't seen the show before. And because I had my own series that was busy being canceled on ABC the day before. So I just hopped over to Seinfeld. But
same line.
It isn't the same. The thing that is peculiar about Seinfeld is you have to play it as a drama. It's got to be Streetcar Named Desire. You have to have that kind of ferocity and that type of commitment to the passion of what's being done in the scene, or it's not funny. So the more passionately you do the scene, and you look at George Costanza, I mean, there could not have been a more tour de force, passionate actor than Jason Alexander. But he made that show because he was passionate about what George was – his dilemma –
Is that acting, period? Because I've only taken a handful of acting. Is that what acting is, really?
Well, if you look at Golden Girls or something, they didn't have to suffer that type of thing. They could just set the joke up and deliver the punchline. But Seinfeld didn't have punchlines. We weren't a joke funny show. It was a situation that was funny. And the more passionately you play that situation, then it becomes funny.
And Jerry would be the first one to say, I'm the least experienced actor.
Absolutely. And it was like, just get my lines out of the way and then just, you know, allow him to smile through the scene.
Oh.
Yeah.
I forgot the sitcom that just came out and said they looked at Seinfeld, the way they held the phones from the 1990s.
Mm-hmm.
Remember they had the antennas?
Yeah.
And they said they went out of their way not to show any technology mm-hmm. because they never wanted to date it. Not that it's hurt it in syndication.
It sure hasn't. And the only other thing that would date it would be the models of the cars. Jerry's Saab, I think, or an Audi or a Saab. Saab, I think, is what he had. But right. Yeah, that was that's the only thing that dated it. I think Kramer was the first one down in Greenwich Village to use a cell phone. And I think it was the only time.
John O'Hurley, I cannot wait to catch what I thought was the 23rd, but it's the 24th.
24th?
The 24th annual National Dog Show on Thursday, November 17th.
Dogs until 2?
27th, I should say. Mm-hmm. From 12 to 2. Right after the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade. And that'll be on CBS, on NBC.
Yeah, we're going to move it over to NBC now.
You don't mind? Yeah, you know, it makes sense. John, thanks so much.
Hey, it's always great to be with you, Brian.
Right? Enjoy. And maybe you should. I would recommend New York because it would be near me, but it wouldn't do it for the quality of life of your family.
I do understand.
You understand?
I do understand.
Back in a moment.
Illuminating, intriguing, inculcating.
I know some of these words.
It's Brian Kilmeade. Information you want. Truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show. Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen, made for your brain.
So, Stuart, what is your role here, along with looking the part? You want people to feel what it was like when this fort was raging.
Absolutely. So my job as Vice President of Public History here is to immerse our visitors here at Ticonderoga in what it was like to serve here.
What's your goal when the thousands of people come here every year and they want to know about this fort? Your goal is to make them feel what it was like.
I want them to come here and experience what it was like here on a given day, whatever it might have been 250 years ago. I want visitors to experience the smells and the sights, to hear the cannons, but also get a deeper understanding. You know, what did it mean to actually be here? Why were people willing to put their lives on the line here at Ticonderoga?
So that is just a little bit of my new season on What Made America Great. If you want to know a little bit more about this country, our background coming up on year 250, I think you really love this. So far, it's doing very well on Fox Nation. We also went NORAD inside the mountains of Colorado to find out who would survive should there be a nuclear bomb. They've actually made it's unbelievable. It's almost like a science fiction situation. I don't think we've ever had cameras down there before. You will love that feature. Also, Battle of Gettysburg, what happened. It's so widespread. It was hard to do, but we were able to capture it in 40 minutes, what it meant, where Lincoln gave the speech. We'll bring you there if you can't travel there. And then the crossing of the Delaware, you know, freezing that day. It was freezing for Washington on his day.